electrify everything.
We have to electrify your cars. We have to electrify your water heaters. We have to electrify the furnace or space heating machines in the house. We eventually have to electrify the kitchens, the ovens, and the cooktops. We have to electrify the laundry. The gas dryers need to become electric. We need to do the same thing in our small businesses, which have similar loads. And we also need to do that as fast as we can, because the reality now is if we adhere to a schedule that is replacing every machine at the end of its life with a cleanly powered electric one, the committed emissions of the machines that already exist today that are going to live out their natural life, will take us to about 1.8. So to come in at 1.8, we now need perfect execution, and that's the other side of that sort of electrify everything and play the end game now, because, you know, we can't use any more crutches.
That's Saul Griffith. We spend the hour talking with him about his new book, Electrify, an Optimist's Playbook for Our Clean Energy Future. It's about how we can solve the climate crisis, live well, and save money by electrifying everything and powering that electricity with clean energy. That's today's menu on Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Time to solve the climate crisis is running short. This week, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that with member states' current emission reduction commitments they have yet to fulfill, the world is on a catastrophic pathway to 2.7 degrees of heating. That would almost certainly result in runaway global warming that would render our Earth uninhabitable. That horrific scenario is what my guest, scientist, engineer, entrepreneur, and energy expert, Saul Griffith, is determined to forestall. He says our failure to fix climate change is just a failure of imagination, that we have the tools right now to make the transition that will lead to vastly cheaper, cleaner energy with no loss in our standard of living. And it gives us a good chance at surviving into the next century. Sound too good to be true? Griffith lays it all out in impressive detail in his book, Electrify. It's a manual with a message. If we get the government policy right, every American household can make the transition to clean energy by the latter half of this decade and save an average of $2,500 per year. I've already begun the process with solar panels on my roof, an electric car, an electric kitchen, electric washer and dryer, and heat pumps for my heating and cooling and water heating. I can tell you it's doable. But we need federal and state governments to step up to the plate to help everybody do it, no matter their income. Saul Griffith says we need to pass at the minimum the climate provisions of the two infrastructure bills now in Congress. Waiting will cost us not only billions, if not trillions of dollars, not only lives, but our futures as well. Saul Griffith is a co-founder of Rewiring America, which is working to launch a movement that electrifies everything. He's also the founder and chief scientist at Other Lab. Saul Griffith, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
You are the founder and chief scientist at Other Lab. Are you at Other Lab in San Francisco now?
Other Lab has a number of offices now, including Dublin, Sydney, and Portland, Oregon, but I'm in head office in San Francisco.
Listeners to the show probably know that we have run out of time to wait to address the climate emergency. We have to make the changes now, not 10 years from now. As you say in this really important book, Electrify. You say we need a new narrative about the climate crisis, one not based on sacrifice. What do you mean by that?
The first time America had an energy crisis was the oil crisis of the 1970s. It followed, it was in 1973, and it followed right on the heels of Earth Day and the birth of the modern environmentalist movement. And on when they analyzed the problem, the sort of solution, consensus solution of the US at that point was that it was a supply-side problem. 15% of our oil had been cut off, and you could solve it if you made every car 15% more efficient, and if you made every furnace and hot water heater 15% more efficient. So our policy solutions for the last energy crisis we had gave us CAFE standards and ENERGY STAR appliances, and it gave us a narrative of efficiency that I think the environmentalist movement has been stuck in for 50 years, and I think has been a cause of, I think, some part of the culture war around climate solutions, because it sounds, you know, all the solutions proposed so far have been have less, live in a smaller, colder house, and ride public transport, which I think is a very different, difficult narrative to get consensus behind in the US. The climate crisis of 2020 is also an energy crisis. You know, about 90% of American, more than 80% of global emissions are energy related. So it really is an energy crisis at heart. But we now can solve the climate crisis without those traditional efficiency and deprivation narratives. We really, you know, it looks like we can address the climate crisis as we have it without completely disrupting the fabric of our lives, not changing enormously the shapes of our suburbs or the sizes of our homes or even the shapes and traffic patterns of our vehicles. Now, it might be good to also to change a lot of those things, but it's not the necessary action in terms of fixing climate change. So I think it's now possible to have a climate change solution narrative that's more about abundance and better. Things can be cleaner, faster, healthier, and solve climate change. So that's the long form answer of your simple question. What do I mean by it doesn't need to be a deprivation narrative?
It reminds me of a video I saw, I think taking place in your home country in Australia, of a real outback farmer driving, could it be the prototype electrified F-150? Anyway, it's a pickup truck. It's an electric pickup truck. And he accelerates. I have an electric vehicle, so I know the delight of acceleration with those vehicles. And he accelerates and he just goes, you know, woohoo!
There's a delightful YouTube series in Australia that's basically a guy with a Tesla that drives from coal town to coal town and lets coal miners drive a Tesla. And it has the similar reaction of this year. Very strong, stoic sort of coal mining characters, you know, squealing with the delight of young children when they drive this Tesla and have their minds changed about climate change.
Exactly. So, Saul Griffith, in Electrify, you say electrification is the only real strategy for what you call hashtag endgame decarbonization. What is endgame decarbonization, and why is electrification the only real strategy for it?
In maybe the 1980s or the 1990s, when climate change first came to the attention of the general population, or at least the listening population, you could still imagine that we could get to the finish line with a transition via natural gas or via some biofuels. But we've left the carbon game so late that we can't afford, but we need to get to fully decarbonized infrastructure in our next move. We can't get there in two moves because we will consume too much or generate too much carbon on the way there. So what I mean by end game is it's now time that any fossil-fueled machine in your life at its end of life has to be replaced with something that's electric and not driven by some substitute fuel. To hit our climate targets of, you know, as close to 1.5 degrees as we can get, because unfortunately 1.5 is in the short term out of the question, we just need to make sure that every fossil fueled machine is the last version of itself.
Yeah, we should point out we're at 1.1 degrees Celsius already, and we are already seeing the horrific toll of the climate catastrophe upon us. So just imagine going over that. Now, when you say electrify everything, give us some examples. I mean, obviously electric cars, but there's a lot more to that as well.
Again, and just to, I think it's useful to understand how as a society we construct our thinking around the climate issue. And a lot of it does go back to that supply side crisis that was the oil crisis. So we think a lot about, okay, and you hear a lot of news stories, we have to not build any new coal plants, we have to build wind farms instead, we have to stop building natural gas plants, we need solar plants instead. And yes, those are true, but that's really just the supply side. That's a small number of very large machines is how I like to put it. On the demand side, it's all of our machines that we experience in our daily lives as householders, as small business owners. And it's literally billions of small machines and small decisions. So that means we have to electrify your cars. We have to electrify your water heaters. We have to electrify the furnace or space heating machines in the house. We eventually have to electrify the kitchens, the ovens and the cooktops. We have to electrify the laundry. The gas dryers need to become electric. We need to do the same thing in our small businesses, which have similar loads. And we also need to do that as fast as we can, because the reality now is if we adhere to a schedule that is replacing every machine at the end of its life with a cleanly powered electric one, the committed emissions of the machines that already exist today that are going to live out their natural life will take us to about 1.8. So to come in at 1.8, we now need perfect execution. And that's the other side of that sort of electrify everything and play the end game now, because, you know, we can't use any more crutches.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Saul Griffith about his book, Electrify. It's about how we can beat the climate crisis, improve our standard of living, and save money by electrifying everything and powering that electricity with clean energy. You say that this will mean a lot more electricity will be needed. You say in order to electrify everything, America will need more than 3 times the electricity it currently produces. First of all, so this is a two-part question. First of all, why? But then you also say that we will use half the energy that we currently use. So how does that work, that we need more than 3 times the electricity we currently use, but we'll use half the energy that we use right now?
So how that works is quite simple. The majority of the energy we use is fossil fuels, driving all of our cars, heating our buildings and powering our power plants that make our electricity. And they're not very efficient. And a lot of the burning of those fossil fuels is wasted as heat. So the US uses 100 quadrillion British thermal units a year. Sort of, you don't really need to remember the numbers, just sort of remember the ratios. Measured in a constant amount of power, that means the American economy runs on about 3.5 terawatts of power. The electricity that we use today averages out at about 440 gigawatts. So it's about 15% of that total 3.5 terawatts. That tera is a trillion and a giga is a billion. So you might think of it as 100 gigawatts versus 440 gigawatts electric. When you drive an electric car, it uses about 1/3 of the energy of a petrol-powered or gasoline-powered car. When you use a heat pump to heat a building, it uses about 1/3 of the energy of a natural gas, which is the the typical way we do it. And if you generate electricity with solar or wind, you eliminate almost 60, a little over 60% of energy that is wasted when we burn coal or natural gas to generate electricity. So the reason electricity needs to triple is because we're going to electrify that huge load as represented by our 280 million vehicles. And we're going to electrify the heating systems in 120 million households and 6 million commercial buildings. So that's where the tripling comes from. But those machines waste far less energy in terms of waste heat than the fossil fuel equivalents. So that's why our total amount of energy goes down from 3,500 gigawatts to 3.5 terawatts to about 1,500 gigawatts.
I found very interesting that the fossil fuel industry producing, moving, transporting, storing fossil fuels takes up a big bunch of our carbon budget, of our fossil fuel energy budget. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's quite shocking. If you, I did a study with the Department of Energy looking at, in very great detail at all of the energy flows in the U.S. A lot of this book is about that study in some more narrative form. But just to sort of highlight a few of the things, close to 2% of the energy used in the U.S. is used in exploring and operating our drilling platforms for oil and natural gas. About close to 1% of the energy flow in the U.S. is using natural gas to push natural gas through the millions of miles of natural gas pipeline, because you've got to give the gas a push to overcome the resistance. Probably about 1% of U.S. energy flow is using diesel in trains to pull rail cars full of coal from where the coal is mined to where it's burned. And around 3 or 4% of oil, of energy in the U.S. is burned to convert oil into gasoline. And so you add up all of those pieces and you find out that, you know, close to 10% of our whole of the energy used to run the whole economy is in the finding, mining, refining, and transporting fossil fuels.
And how does that compare to the energy used by wind power or solar?
The final answer isn't in yet, but I think most or a lot of experts now agree that if we were instead supplying all of our energy with solar and wind and a little bit of hydroelectricity, maybe some nuclear, and then we were using a lot of batteries, that to find, mine, and refine all of that silicon, all of the steel for the windmills, all of the lithium for the batteries will be less than 10%. I'm reasonably optimistic it will be about 5% of the current energy use. So I think we will get a discount in the future.
And of course, that doesn't include technological change. I mean, I recently saw a prototype of a new kind of offshore wind farm that, let's see, it's taller, but it uses much smaller blades. They rotate it's difficult to describe, but it's kind of like a rectangular platform that goes up very high.
I saw the one you mean. I think the general challenge you're talking about is to harness renewable resources, the machines necessarily have to be big, because to interfere with a lot of wind, to capture the wind, and to interfere with a lot of the sun to capture the solar. And so the engineering job is at hand is to build the lightest possible machine you can to cover the biggest area, because in some very simple sense, how much the machine costs is proportional to how much it weighs. And so most of the innovations involved in solar and wind at this point are figuring out how to make the machines lighter and cheaper.
Yes, and this one had much smaller blade. I mean, much smaller blades. So they didn't look like regular windmills. In any event, the point being that the actual energy used to produce these machines may in fact go down. Hopefully, will.
You know, there's an associated question. It will go down, and it always does. There's things known as industrial learning curves. We learn as we do, and so that's how these things improve slowly. you know, solar is increasing its capacity factor, which is how effectively it captures daylight around the clock, by about 1% or 2% per year. Batteries are improving at 2 or 3% per year. And just like any compound interest rate, that really adds up over one or two decades to very significant, you know, halving the cost or doubling the efficiency of these types of things. And then a corollary to this point, and I want to emphasize this to people, people wrestle with the question, well, aren't we going to have to make too many solar cells? Aren't we going to have to make too many batteries? Can we do it? And the answer is yes, there is enough of all of the materials, but the story is actually even better than that. To power the average American lifestyle today, about 6,000 kilograms or six metric tons of material, fossil fuels, is mined and burned every year. If you were supplying that same American lifestyle, half of it with wind-generated electricity, half of it with solar-generated electricity, and you had to store roughly half of that energy in batteries, then that American lifestyle will need about 50 kilograms of wind-powered machine built every year for it, 50 kilograms of solar machine, and then 50 kilograms of batteries. Now, in the case of the fossil fuels, they're burned once and they're left in the atmosphere. In the case of windmills and solar cells and batteries, we're learning to recycle them and recycle them at very high and effective rates. And so I think it's a much smaller burden on the world to be using that 150 kilograms a year of recyclable materials compared to the 6,000 kilograms of fossil fuels that are single use, which is the way we do it today.
Mm. Well, that is illustrative indeed, and that's a really great example there. You know, one of the things you do in this book, Saul Griffith, that I think would be of great interest to our listeners is that you talk about the personal zero carbon infrastructure. In other words, how, you know, what it will take to actually electrify everything that we use. I've already started on this. I have solar panels on my roof. I have an electric vehicle that I charge at home. I put in a heat pump for heating and cooling. And I have a hybrid water heater that is hybrid electric and heat pump. My stove and oven are electric, as are my washing machine and dryer. I don't have any gas coming to my house. But I did find that it was a lot more expensive than what you talk about as an examples in the book. You say that to electrify everything will be much cheaper, but the upfront costs are pretty high. I wonder if you could talk about this conundrum.
I think there are two questions, and I'd love to answer the first one because I think it's really important. And then I'd like to give you a short answer on the first question, and then a long answer on the second one about cost. But the first answer was about your personal infrastructure. And here's why I think this is a really important point. The 50 years of environmentalist thinking sort of culminated in that unsatisfying moment at the end of Inconvenient Truth, or at the end of any of these conferences that you go to, where you're given the impression that the solution for climate change is to buy a stainless steel drinking bottle or to recycle your plastic bags. Now, those are good and worthy things to do, but they make barely a difference on your personal carbon footprint. In reality, about 42% of the emissions in the US are the result of decisions you make around your kitchen table. And there's only about a half a dozen of them, and I think you mentioned nearly all of them. And it's the decisions about what fuels your car, what fuels your water heater, what fuels your space heater, what fuels your kitchen, what fuels your laundry, and then the bigger question, where do you get all of that electricity from? And so I think it's easier for average people living their very busy lives that include children and parents and all of the complications of being human to, rather than stress out about every single purchasing decision and am I buying the right can of tuna, you know, did I forget to bring my reusable shopping bag every day, and understand that if you make those seven or eight infrastructure decisions well in your life, that's how you eliminate carbon in a permanent way, because water heaters last 12 years, furnaces last 20 years, cars last 20 to 25 years, your roof lasts 15 to 25 years. So if you want to make those decisions correctly, and then you get a big carbon discount for the lifetime of the machines. So that's, you know, like, again, your cars, your rooftop for your solar generation to make some of your electricity clean, where you buy your electricity, so signing up for a green electricity plan with your utility, what type of machinery is in your laundry, what type of machinery is in your kitchen, hopefully electric. Are you using a heat pump for your space heat and a heat pump for your water heater? So, they're the pieces of personal infrastructure. Now, you're right. If you go out today in 2021 to buy those things, the electric car will probably be more expensive than, well, will be more expensive than a gasoline car.
Well, except for the, I got something like, how much, about almost $10,000 in rebates.
Yeah, so the rebates are good. I think we need rebates. You know, we can get to this, but I think the government should actually be helping develop the market for all of these machines, so that, you know, just paying the retail price without rebates today, you would pay about $10,000 extra for each car. You'd probably pay $1,000 more for the induction cooktop instead of the natural gas cooktop. You might pay a few hundred dollars more for the pump water heater instead of a natural gas water heater. You might pay $1,000 or a few thousand dollars more for the heat pump heating for your home. And then in the US, you pay $3 a watt to install solar on your roof. If you added all that up, and we just did this study in the US, and now I've also just recently done the study in Australia, but the average American home spends about $4,500 a year on energy. If you bought all of those machines that I mentioned and you financed them today, your energy costs would go up, because you're turning your energy costs into financing costs, because you have to borrow the money to buy these things. So it would go up by $3,000 or $4,000 a year this year, but the price of batteries is falling precipitously. The price of electric vehicles is getting very close to the same as the price of petrol vehicles. The famous example now is the Ford F-150. You'll be able to buy an electric Ford F-150 for $40,000 next year, which is about the same price as the petrol one. Solar in America can get much cheaper. In Australia, which has similar wages and similar in many respects, solar is installing on people's rooftops at $1 a watt, which means their electricity costs 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour, which is cheaper than anywhere in the US. That will be possible in the US when we get our regulatory environment right. So if you model out the future where the costs of all of these things have fallen, by 2023, 2024, every home in America starts to save money. And really, the reason we want these rebate programs, like the rebate program you mentioned for your electric vehicle, is to help build the market and help build the manufacturing capacity and the supply chain, so that, you know, as soon as possible, every American home can be saving money. And that's really the reason we should have something that looks like a Green New Deal. We can call it in anything. We could call it more like the Arsenal democracy, if you like, with meaning a massive buildup of industry to be able to provide all of these things more cost effectively.
And that's exactly what we're talking about in the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill. You know, climate activists are talking about $2 trillion of that being for climate infrastructure and for those kinds of incentives included in that. One thing is about batteries. Now, you know, we see now New Orleans is still without power. We are seeing extreme weather, whether it's fires or hurricanes or floods, coming, you know, just about every week, sometimes a couple of times a week. and, you know, the thought did come to me that, well, I've put off buying the home batteries because at this point they're about $9,000 for 8 hours of storage. You know, in other words, an 8 hour storage battery. You have to get two of them. That's $18,000, and that's with the rebates. It's just a whole lot of money to put in. But it seems to me that we're going to be incredibly vulnerable if we don't kind of decentralize, at least as a backup plan, our energy storage and not just depend on the grid. If we're all electrified, what are we going to do when the power goes out?
Oh, we will have much more diversified sources, and there'll be a lot of community-generated solar and solar generated on your roof. So not all of the power will go out at once as it does in today's systems. And I'm going to be a little playful with this answer, but I'll just start with a couple of the numbers. The average American house uses about 20 kilowatt hours of electricity a day. The Ford F-150 is probably going to ship with an 80 or 100 kilowatt hour battery. That means the battery in that car could run your all of your home loads for 4 or 5 days. You got to remember that in the average American garage, there's 1.9 vehicles. So you'll be able to run the house for nearly 10 days on your two vehicles. And that's if your own solar has failed. If your own solar is producing, you'll be able to go off the grid for longer. I think the price of batteries, the home battery right now, is very, very high. A lot of that is because of regulatory reasons and because it's an early market. But weirdly, if you just bought that F-150 and parked it next to your house, it would be cheaper per hour of storage than that home battery. And so I think we've, you know, the problem is getting from here to there. And what I mean is from what we have now to the future. You can actually kind of imagine a future where you retrofit the vintage motorcycle that you love with an electric battery, and you retrofit your old car, and you buy an electric jet ski. And all of a sudden, these things that you traditionally categorized in your life as your toys become your part of your backup battery system. And I think people really don't appreciate just how prolific the number of batteries in the system will be when we, you know, have 1.9 electric vehicles parked in our garage, an electric motorcycle as well, and solar on our roof, and batteries in our appliances. There really will be a situation of batteries everywhere, including using your hot water system as a battery by using yesterday's solar that heated up the water to have tomorrow's shower, and doing the same thermal storage with for the heating of your home and the cooling of your home. So we are not there yet, and the prices are not quite there. But once again, we see the projected prices for batteries by 2025 being 10% of what the price of that battery is that you're currently getting bid for on your home. So we're in the very, very early days, but we're on the cusp of it transforming the economics for the house. And in fact, you know, we modeled it out for the US, and by, you know, 2028, towards the end of this decade, the average US home, even after purchasing and financing all of these 7 or 8 pieces of infrastructure, will be saving close to $2,500 a year on their cost of energy.
Saul Griffith talking about his book, Electrify. Stay tuned for more after the break.
The Midas is loveless, he talks to the land, and the leaves fall and the pond overrises. She don't know the system, plus she don't understand. She's got all her own fuses and splices. She's not gonna fix it all. Sticky iron black, and the copper proud-headed Queen Lizzie conducts little charges that don't get charged back. Well, the technical manual's busy. She's not gonna fix it all too easy. And she holds out a flashlight and she shines it on me. She wants me to tell her what with a good dog and some trees out of touch with the breakdown of this century. They're not gonna fix it all too easy.
Electricity by Joni Mitchell. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. We're talking with inventor, entrepreneur, and clean energy maven Saul Griffith about his book, Electrify, an optimist playbook for our clean energy future. It's about how we can beat the climate crisis, improve our standard of living, and save money by electrifying everything and powering that electricity with clean energy. When we left off before the break, Griffith was talking about how there will be batteries everywhere when we electrify everything, and they will be able to supply power to us even when the grid goes out. That will make us much more resilient, power-wise, when extreme weather takes down the grid. And that really brings up another important point in your book, in Electrify, Saul Griffith. What it brings up is that we have to have a real coordination of creating a 21st century grid, creating a new kind of industrial system. You know, my Nissan Leaf, I know that the F-150 can power a home, but my Nissan Leaf can't. It's got a battery, but I can't use that battery to power my home. So everything is going to have to be done in a way, as you say, everything that can store energy should store energy, but it has to be built in a way that it can store and provide energy.
Yeah, it's amazing. You write your manuscript a year or more before the book comes out, and I've been thinking and talking about all of these issues a lot ever since. And the way I now say this, express it, is that the more things you electrify, the easier it gets to electrify all of the things. And that really means that there's benefits from making sure that when we electrify industry, it's connected to the grid, because industrial loads occur at different times of the day to our residential loads. You know, there's a lot of electricity use in your house when people are home in your house through the evening and in the morning, but when everyone goes off to school or goes off to work or goes off to recreation, the loads go into the commercial sector. And so if we're going to balance these loads minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day, week to week, and over the year, we get more and more benefit by electrifying all of those sectors and diversifying them. And we get more benefit if the vehicles are available as batteries. There's been something of a intellectual property battle over, you know, there were patents filed that prevented some car companies from connecting to the grid and others could play, and some, you know, so we're still living in the early Wild West where people are seeking to, monopolies are seeking to collect rents on some of these ideas, whereas we really just need almost a mandate to make sure that, you know, everything that can connect to the grid and play fair by egalitarian rules does connect to the grid.
Yeah, and you talk about grid neutrality. In fact, you talk about rewriting the rules. So I want to ask you, what does that mean? Not just grid neutrality, but other ways in which we have to rewrite the rules to create the grid that we need.
Well, I think rewriting the rules, I mean, not only in respect to the grid, but actually to all of our energy infrastructure. Another way to say it is fossil fuels and fossil fuel interests have been astoundingly successful at giving us our 20th century and 21st century lifestyles that we enjoy. And they did that and wrote the regulations and the rules for the road for fossil fuels in concert with the way we developed our building codes, the way we planned our cities, the way we do all these things. So there's a whole bunch of regulatory burden around things like building codes that are not making solar on our rooftops as cheap as it needs to be. Part of the reason the battery on the side of your house is more expensive than the battery in a toy you might buy your child is because we've got safety regulations and building code regulations around where that battery can be. So we need to look carefully at all of those regulations and try to change them all to make sure that this future is as economically favorable as possible, as affordable as possible. And the biggest and most important one of those regulations of all is the way we regulate the electricity grid. The grand compromise in the US was made early in the 20th century, which granted effective monopolies to the utilities in exchange for guaranteeing very highly reliable electricity and certain limitations on not being able to overcharge certain groups of people. And that gave the utilities all of the power in setting the rules of the road, if you'd like, of who can connect to the grid, who can sell electricity to it, and who can store electricity from it. It's those rules that are in conflict with us all connecting our cars and occasionally letting, you know, my car power your morning cup of tea. And it's those rules that are preventing the solar cells on your roof from heating the water in my hot water heater when you're out of your house. So the concept of grid neutrality that we talk about, and it's a very sort of highly principled, high level kind of idea, which will need to be manifest in all types of regulations. But it's the general principle that we need to treat everything that can generate electricity and everything that can store electricity equally and not play favorites with the utilities' assets, not set the rates at the utility rate hearings that prevent people from benefiting from having a battery on their house or solar on their roof. So we, in effect, I think we need sort of a people or household-friendly set of rules for the grid that makes sure that an individual generating solar and storing energy is treated with the same rules of the road as the utilities are.
The book Electrify focuses on what you say, on what is technically necessary. And I found it fascinating, the depth that you go into in describing just exactly how we can electrify everything technologically speaking. But you say you don't focus on what's politically possible. That could be a problem, because that's been the problem all along with us being able to move ahead on climate action as the world is burning around us. So, and for example, you say we have to end fossil fuel subsidies, which I completely agree with. But the fossil fuel lobby is lobbying right now very intensively with Senator Joe Manchin to make sure that he stops the infrastructure bill from going forward. You have a plan to get the fossil fuel giants on board. Tell us what that is.
Oh, before we get there, I'm Rewiring America, which is an organization I started around the same time I started writing this book, to advocate for electrification. We've literally been doing hand-to-hand combat, writing components of the policy for this infrastructure bill. And it is indeed hand-to-hand combat with Joe Manchin's office and the natural gas industry that's behind the scenes. So I've stared that evil in the face. I think Joe Manchin, I think the corrupting Joe Manchin may actually have his constituents' near-term interests in his mind, so taking a generous interpretation. I'm not sure he's ever really had anyone able to sit down with him and explain, you know what, if you work through this electrify everything paradigm, we will be saving your constituents thousands of dollars by the middle of this decade per year, and that will be very significant to his constituents. But the people whispering in his ear are whispering that all of this won't work out. The real remedy, the question you're asking me about, what do I recommend to do with the fossil fuel companies, is about, I think we can fight them to the death, which is how it feels like it's going, or we can figure out how to put them on side. So if you opened your heart and you ignored some of the more cynical things that fossil fuel companies have done, you'd have to say, thank you, you provided a high quality of life during the 20th century. The consequence was this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that is a problem, but nevertheless, thanks for getting us here. Also, you have expertise in building reliable energy systems, and you have a lot of competent people in your organizations. Why don't we help you transition to become big players in the future energy landscape. And if that means that we have to buy, you know, the reason that the fossil fuel company is fighting so hard is ultimately they have already booked the balance of their, there's a thing called proven reserves. I'll expand this story and go back in history a little bit. Somewhere just before the turn of the 20th century, somebody had an oil well in Texas. It was producing so many barrels a day and they couldn't quite afford to drill the next hole. So they went to the bank and said, look, my current well is producing this many barrels of oil and my geologists have estimated that there's so much oil in reserve in that well. Can I use that to borrow money to drill my next well? And in doing that, they invented the concept of proven reserves, which is putting on your balance sheet as a company fossil fuels that are still in the ground. The big problem is that everyone did that, and we now know that fossil fuels that already exist on the balance sheets are more than enough to take us well over 2 and even over 3 degrees of warming. So we've got to keep it all in the ground, but that's a problem to these fossil fuel companies because it's already an asset. So they would have to write off those assets, which would have very negative effects because, you know, everyone's pension fund has some of those assets at the bottom of the pile. So I feel like we should be, in essence, collectively purchasing those assets off the fossil fuel companies under the agreement that they use the returns to invest in clean energy and transition to become clean energy companies. We need some solution like this to break the logjam.
I absolutely agree with you. As much as I hate them, I think they are the most evil companies in the world. But we need to survive and we need to do whatever we can to get them on our side. And
but they're also evil companies that employ good people.
Well, that's true.
And there's a few million good people who work for those fossil fuel companies, and they are highly skilled and they are highly responsible in the sense that they provide good energy or usable energy cheaply. And we need to transition their skills and their jobs into the new energy economy. And there's more than enough room for them. And I think it's going to be enough of a struggle to train all of the people we need anyway, that we shouldn't leave anyone out of the workforce required to get this giant task done, including those people working at existing fossil energy firms.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Saul Griffith about his book, Electrify, an optimist playbook for our clean energy future. Well, let me ask you, you say you've been working on, you know, aspects of this infrastructure bill. What about this idea that you have? I mean, how general is it? I mean, is this something that's being talked about at some of the highest reaches of government, or is this, you know, just something that is being left in the wayside?
This hasn't been floated yet anywhere to my knowledge, and I think that might be part of the reason there's not a lot of support from the Republicans for this infrastructure bill, you know, apart from the ideological war that seems to be contemporary American politics. There's really, you know, no one is, I always imagine this is the grand compromise that we'll need to make to get people in. Quite frankly, the bills that we've written so far do not get us on target for a 1.5 degree world, not anywhere close. My disappointment is we're still, you know, again, back to that origin story. There was no Department of Energy in 1973 when the oil crisis landed on Nixon's desk. In the next 5 years, we analyzed the American energy economy. We drew up the sectors and the boundaries between them. And we've been talking about the industry sector, the commercial sector, the residential, the transportation and the electricity sector, these five sectors ever since. And we've never really connected them. And we're writing policy and the infrastructure bill right now. We're writing the Clean Electrification Act separately from the Clean Cars for America Act, separately from the Zero Emissions Homes and Hope for Homes Act. realistically, we need to be talking about all of those three things together because they're all now related and connected by this thing called electricity. And they're not sufficiently ambitious individually and definitely not sufficiently ambitious collectively. And unfortunately, we have not yet started to have the conversation at the national level of how are we going to do the transition justly, not only for the communities, typically low income and people of color communities that are worst affected by fossil fuel pollution, but also how do we transition the existing fossil fuel workforce elegantly as we do this. We'd like to make the disruptions positive for all people, and that is possible, but it's not possible while we're still having the small conversation and in, you know, each sector without them having a grand unifying theory.
So what do we need to do to make that part of our, you know, what you're talking about, not just the grand compromise, but also the coordination between all these different sectors? What do we need to do to make that happen? And I know that your book is not about the politics, but the politics is key to making sure that this happens.
What I really meant when I said the book isn't about the politics is if you begin with the, you know, and every politician will tell it to this phrase to you in your first or second meeting with them, that politics is the art of the possible. So if we begin with that overused sentence, we will never get the climate outcome we want. We literally have to change the politics. That's what I really mean when I don't want to consider what is politically possible right now, because we have to transform the dialogue and make new politics possible. New politics is becoming possible very rapidly because the economics quietly, you know, for the last 30 years, the people working in solar, the people working in electric vehicles, the people working in batteries and working in wind power, have in working in microgrids, have made all of the costs drop. So the conversation is getting much more possible every day because the economics are finally close to making sense. But we talked a little bit about this earlier. It's like, it's not quite true in 2021. If you or I electrified out, I just finished building an all electric home and my all electric vehicles, just the same recipe as you. And I know I paid a little bit more than if I had have gone with fossil fuels. But we know that we could, by virtue of the fact that there's, you know, we've got to put 80 million solar panels on American roofs. We've got to build 200 million electric vehicles. All the prices are going to drop as a function of doing this national project. And when they do, the economics is going to work for everyone in 2024, 2025. The problem is we don't have the time to waste. We need to write the policy now that anticipates that world. But the problem is, we're still fighting over whether electrification is the answer or some other magical thing. And that really was the theme of the book. Look, it's electrification. It's is what we need to do. We can't rely on negative carbon emissions, all these magical other things. And we need to plan for that electric future now. And by virtue of doing that, we need to make it. We need to make this politics possible. And that means we need to be telling the story about what we have to win and when we have to win it, which is it's about 2025 where the economics will be positive for every American household. So we need to be writing policy in 2021 that anticipates that and builds towards that. And quite frankly, we need to build, there's still not enough, let's call it centrist middle class support for these climate solutions. So another thing I'm trying to achieve with my book is to show you that you don't have to be scared. We're not going to lose touch with the things that Americans enjoy, meaning their lifestyle and the American dream, which is still a bit of a dream, although it's had a fairly rocky few years. But we can get there and the economics will be positive, but it won't unless the people demand it. And we still need to build more retail political cover to allow, I think the White House we have genuinely wants to solve this problem, but they still don't have enough support in the face of the you know, Joe Manchin fossil fuel company opposition. We need to build that support and we need to build that around a positive vision for the future. of what we have to win, what we have to gain. Homes that have cleaner air quality in them because we've eliminated the methane emissions inside your house. Communities that have better water quality and better air quality because we've eliminated the fossil fuels being burned in those communities. We need to tell those positive stories of what we have to win, both environmentally, in health terms, and economically. And they all will, but our chance is rapidly being burned away to actually do that and hit our climate targets. So it's the urgency, and you know, we need to build the political army that supports this. We need to build it in every community.
Hear, hear. And I think your book, Saul Griffith, Electrify, is an important contribution to that project. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and thank you so much for the work that you're doing.
Thank you, and thank you for the electrification of your own life that you're doing. If only everyone will follow in your footsteps.
I love it. That's all I can say is every time I make something cleaner, I feel better.
You know, Rewiring America, we've been trying to figure out how to have the most impact. And you might appreciate this by the sounds of things. You know, the AARP, American Association of Retired People?
Of course.
The joke in Washington is that it has its own zip code. It literally has its fingers on every piece of legislation. In terms of a political force, it makes the NRA look like a high school debate. They're huge. And we need an AARP for climate. I have real conviction that the political piece that's missing now isn't the will at the Democrats. It's the retail support in the suburbs. And we're not going to do it unless we start to have some positive storytelling around where we can get to.
Well, again, thank you. Thank you so much. Terrific book and terrific work that you're doing. Very important. And I really, really hope that the White House brings you on board to advise them.
Yeah, trying. We'll see.
That was Saul Griffith talking about his book, Electrify, an optimist playbook for our clean energy future. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Electrify. You'll also find links to Saul Griffith's website, where you can delve in much deeper into the research behind the book. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Raj Patel and Rupa Marya about their book, Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. We also talk with country star Jimmy Allen about his new book for kids, My Voice is a Trumpet. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.